Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv S. Khanna for immigration.com, Law Office of Rajiv S. Khanna, PC. Today is December 15th, as we usually do every other Thursday. This is a community conference call where we answer questions that you folks have posted on the forums, forums.immigration.com. And after that, we take questions that stem from the questions already posted. And then finally, if time remains, we deal with any questions on a walk-in basis. This call is being recorded, so if you wish to keep your identities confidential or do not wish to be recorded, don't speak up. This call will be made publicly available, so you may want to conceal your identity. You can make up a name when you talk with me, Sam, Tom, Green, Harry, whatever. Just because we have agreed to participate in this call or you have agreed to participate in this call does not make us attorney or client with each other. Unless a contract is signed in writing, we are merely providing information to the best of our ability, and you are merely seeking information without entering into any attorney-client relationship. That said, let me get started with the questions that have been posted. First question is from Sandy ABC. This question deals with change of lawyers when your old lawyer is kind of untraceable. So what is going on is that they have an ongoing consular processing case for EB-1, I-140 is approved. Sandy has gone back to their home country, but they're trying to contact their lawyer who's untraceable. National Visa Center has sent invoices to the lawyer. So the questions are, what steps can I take to transfer lawyer at this stage? You can transfer lawyers at any stage. That's not a problem at all. How long will it add to processing time if I transfer lawyer? It should not add. I mean, the new lawyers can pretty much take it on right away. If you have copies of the documents that have been submitted to USCIS, that would be great. Can I make payment directly to NVC? Yes, you can. And submit packet 3 document without the help of lawyer? Sure, no problem. What documents, like approved I-140, do I need from lawyer for subsequent processing and consular interview? You know what I would recommend? Try to get these documents from the lawyer, as well as file a form G, as in girl, 639 with the USCIS for a copy of all your records that USCIS has. It's called a Freedom of Information Act / Privacy Act request. So if you ask for those documents from USCIS, you'll get a copy from them. It'll take a few months. In the meantime, you can process this paperwork. What would your advice be in such a situation? Well, like I said, first thing you need to do is contact the bar where the lawyer is admitted, see if the lawyer is debarred or no longer in business. You know, basically, you need to find out if you can get the information and the paperwork directly from the lawyers. That will make things a lot easier for you. In the meantime, file your G-639. Also, contact NVC directly and start paying the fees and the documentation, completing the documentation for them. Okay? Then, same user, second question. I discourage people from posting more than one set of questions. However, it's okay for this time. My cousin has an approved perm and I-140 with employer A. So the question is, you've got 1 year remaining in your ninth year H-1 extension. If you apply in the ninth year for another employer, can you still get 3 more years of H-1? The answer is you should be able to. If the I-140 has been approved, typically you are paying for the extension. You should be able to get 3 years. This is my understanding. Okay? So if he decides to join employer C and transfer his H-1B, and so this question talks about, will he get a 3-year extension or will transfer be valid till the end of his current visa? Yeah, he should be able to get 3 years. What happens if he decides to work for employer B, gets perm approved by employer B, then joins employer C? Will he get 3-year extension or the extension is valid? The way it worked is he's got an I-140 approval from A, then he joined B, now he's planning to join C. So I don't see any problem because the extensions can be based on employer A's I-140. So he should still be able to get a 3-year extension with employer C, even if B's perm gets approved. Okay. Next question from Kavita K, the I-485 questions. What I did was these questions were important enough that I upgraded them to my blog. So if you go to my blog, one easy way to do is just go to immigration.com, and when you look at the top bar, there's immigration.com blog. If you click on that, you'll see I-485 FAQ as the first blog entry that I just posted, and I have posted the answers to these questions on my blog. But I'll answer them again because I think some of them need a little discussion. So question number one, typically how long does it take to receive advance parole and EAD after filing I-485? The answer is EAD, 90 days. Advance parole, typically 3 to 6 months, sometimes less, sometimes more. But these times are variable. Question number two, I don't have an H-1B visa stamp. Can I travel outside while the 485 is pending? And the answer is don't do that. There is some law where question number two and three are kind of related, where we have seen USCIS to say that, well, let me take a step back. The way it works is, if you want to travel when the 485 is pending, stepping outside USA will render your 485 abandoned, which means it's over. If you step outside USA while your 485 is pending. However, there are two exceptions. One, if you have advance parole, then no problem. You can travel outside during the life of your advance parole, but you must have advance parole in hand before you travel. Second is, if you have an H1 or L1 or H4 or L2 visa stamped on your passport, you don't have AP, AP is still pending, but you traveled with the visa, is that a problem? No, not a problem. But here is the tricky part. What if you don't have the stamp, you just have an approval, like Kavita does, the person who posted this question? I think that becomes risky for two reasons. One practical reason, what if your visa doesn't get stamped? If your visa doesn't get stamped, then your 485 is gone as well. Okay? Second reason is, by some convoluted reasoning, USCIS has actually said that even if you get the visa stamped after you travel out, they might consider the 485 to be abandoned. Very strange comment from one of the USCIS officers in one of the meetings I was attending. So, personally, I think it's strange, but nevertheless, it is best not to travel without the AP if you don't already have a visa stamp. Okay? Question number four. Does the alien have to be in USA for 485 filing? Yes. Do they have to be in USA until AP is approved? I just answered that question. Does visa officer have the ability to cancel AP? No, they don't. In my view, as far as I know, the visa officer cannot cancel your advance parole. Question number six, if my H-1B is denied in my home country, can my spouse enter using H-4 if I entered using advance parole? And the answer is yes. Under Cronin Memorandum, C as in Charlie, R-O-N-I as in N as in Nancy, I-N, Cronin Memorandum, if you enter USA on advance parole to resume work on a valid H-1, you are still considered to be on H-1. Accordingly, your spouse should be able to enter on H-4. Cronin Memorandum is posted on our website. Just type the word Cronin on the search fields on immigration.com and forums.immigration.com, both sites. Question number seven. This is important. At what point of time during GC process do I need to add my spouse? Should it be before filing of I-485 or before visa number? The answer is before 485 approval. So if you add your spouse before 485 approval, they will either get the green card with you or very soon thereafter. Okay? But if your 485 is approved, then they have to go through the process of following to join. Again, it is possible, let's take the scenario where the spouse is already in USA. Your 485 is already pending. His or her 485 was filed later. You got your approval. is the spouse in any kind of danger? The answer is no, because their own 485 is pending. Change the scenario. The priority date is not current. Spouse is on H4, you are on H1, your 485 is pending. Priority date becomes current. You have a good 30-day notice, or at least 15-20-day notice. You can file the 485 when the priority date becomes current, because you find out about next month's priority date on about the 15th of the previous month. So you could file his or her 485 as soon as you hear about the priority dates. But if for some reason you miss that time and the priority dates are not current, your 485 gets approved. Let me rephrase that. Your 485 gets approved. They are no longer on H4. They still have 180 days if they don't have any other period of out of status during their last visit. They can still file their 485 over the next 180 days. Okay? So there are several different options depending upon your particular case. Okay? What if you miss the deadline? What if your 485 is approved and you're not married? What happens then? Well, then you have to get your green card, get married, and apply for your spouse under Family Preference Category 2A. So then whatever time it takes, it takes. Okay? Just keep that in mind. Now, let me go on to the next question. Question number 8. I'm a little confused about this. Give me a little minute. I don't know exactly what they're asking. After filing my 485, if my spouse is in USA on H4, will I be able to add my spouse to my 485? Yes. You can add them if the priority date is current. If visa number is available, if 485 is approved, can I still add them? The answer is sure. Sure. If your spouse is in U.S. If they are outside USA, you have to file for their consular processing. That's called following to join. The way it works is, if you are married before your 485 is approved, then your spouse gets the same priority date as you have under your employment-based case. So even if they have to come through consular processing, it's only a few months extra over your green card approval. But if you have not gotten married before your 485 approval, then you have to apply for them under Family Preference 2A, and currently that is for Indians, it's about 2 years backup, but the backup keeps fluctuating from 2, 3, 4, 5 to even 7 years. So it has been going up and down. Last few months, it's been 2 to 4 years, something like that. I hope that made things a little clearer for you. I also hope that you're on the phone right now, and if you have any follow-up questions, I'll be happy to answer them for you. Next question is from Venkatesh. Wife got a job, went from H4 to H1B. So the problem is you got the H1B approval, and H4 was also pending, and you tried to withdraw the H4, but the H4 was approved. Okay. Now, is she on H1 or H4? Venkatesh, nobody can really answer this question definitively. Many years ago, there's something called the last action rule, which means whatever action was taken the last on your particular application, then that is your status. Now, I had a discussion with a very senior USCIS lawyer, business lawyer, USC business immigration lawyer, and she said to me that there was really no grounds or no reason for last action rule. There was really nothing in practice or theory that talked about last action rule. Nobody quite knows where exactly does this last action rule come from. As a practical matter, I feel because you have taken action prior to the H4 approval, you should be able to speak with the USCIS and they should be able to make things right for you. And if you don't want to take a chance of any kind, you can always go get an H1 visa stamp and come back. I know that's easier said than done, but this is one of those areas of the law where nobody quite knows what to do. Okay? So my bottom line advice for you would be to first speak with USCIS, also open a case with Ombudsman's Office, USCIS Ombudsman, see if they can help. And if USCIS can straighten this out for you, great. If not, just go get a visa stamp and come back. Next question is from Pila 76, I-485 pending with Texas Service Center. Under what circumstances can I-485 be rejected? There's really very little I can say here. There are so many ways. Very difficult to say how and when 485 can reject it. The most common ground I have seen of 485 rejection is actually government error. They make mistakes, they assume things, and often illegally I've seen denials. Normally, under the regulations, USCIS is required, if I remember correctly, to issue a notice of intent to deny before they actually deny. But I've seen them deny cases without issuing an NOID. So really, there's no way I can answer how many grounds there can be. Criminal convictions, something wrong with your status, for example. This is a very common ground these days, actually. Let's say the employee was approved under the LCA and the H-1 to work in Washington, D.C. Then they changed their job location to California, but they did not amend the H-1. Now the employee is out of status, and they continued working there for several months or years. Now all of a sudden you're not eligible for 485. So, you know, typically these are some of the more common scenarios: government error, out of status, convictions. So kindly answer below questions. Okay. Spouse worked on EAD and laid off due to lack of work, claimed unemployment. Unemployment benefits are not a problem, but being out of status can be a problem. So unless your spouse is protected by Section 245K, which allows 180 days of being out of status, and this applies to out of status period after your last entry. So if you're out of status for 190 days, and then you left USA and came back in January 2012, your 180 days period gets reset, and all your sins before 2012 regarding out of status get washed away. Not about unlawful presence. Make a very clear distinction here. Unlawful presence is different, and out of status is different. There really are many, many rules, many, many very complicated rules on what is unlawful presence, what is out of status. Generally speaking, if your I-94 has expired, you are not only out of status, you are unlawfully present in U.S. It's probably. Like I said, too many variations. So if she's protected by 245K, no problem. But if she's not, then the 485 will be denied. She'll have to refile after leaving USA and coming back on valid H-4 status, or she'll go through consular processing. So I really don't know the exact case, what is going on, what is not going on. Spouse worked on EAD, and then claimed unemployment benefits. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought she was on H-1. Now, EAD, I don't see any reason why you cannot claim unemployment benefits. To the best of my knowledge, that should not be a problem. Okay, as long as she was not out of status because she was out of work on a visa status that requires her to work, like an H-1 or an L-1. If the only reason for concern you have is that she got unemployment benefits, I don't think that should be a problem. Because unemployment benefits are not means-tested benefits. They are not benefits available based upon what you can afford. They are benefits available to everybody. It's only means-tested benefits that become a problem for green card. Okay? Next question is Alapati, fingerprinting and GC application question. At what point of time do I need to go for fingerprinting? You know what? I don't know. It's been a while since I dealt with the logistics, if I remember correctly. The first time you go for fingerprintings is before your EAD is issued, I think. I could be wrong about this. I think you need to go in for biometrics before any of these documents are issued. Okay? But forgive me, I sometimes don't know all the logistics. There are other people in our team who take care of those things. That should be easy enough for you to find out. If you're not able to find that out, send me an email. The answer is fairly easy for us to find out for you as well. I'm in the West Coast, so where do I need to go for fingerprinting? They tell you which fingerprinting center, or what I think they call them, application support centers, you need to go to. They should be able to tell you. When you get a notice, it'll tell you where to go. Be somewhere close by usually. Also, could you please let me know if I can add my husband to my GC application after it is approved? He's on H-4 and physically present in USA. I've had a fairly long discussion about this in response to a question posted by Kavita above. So you can listen on that, and the answer is yes, you can. Does USCIS give any grace period to add spouse after your green card is approved, primary's green card is approved? You see, the way it would work is if your green card is getting approved, that means the priority date is current. In most cases, there's a very small window of exceptions, but in most cases, your green card will get approved, 485 will get approved only when PD becomes current. When the PD becomes current, your spouse can file their 485 as well. So I don't think this is a real issue. Okay, but you're welcome to ask me any specific questions. I don't believe this is a real issue for most people. How many years of federal income tax returns are required? I think it's 3 years, right, as far as I know, and I think it is for both I-864 as well as 485 is 3 years, I think. I have gaps in H-1B status. That can be a problem, especially if it is with the same employer who did your green card, because USCIS has been asking questions where the green card sponsoring employer had benched you. They can definitely create problems about that. No, but if you, the problem is, you've talked about leaving USA and coming back. You have to leave USA before you file your 485. So if you leave now, it does not correct the problem that has already existed in the 485. What you've got to do is you've got to talk with your lawyers, see if you're not protected by Section 245K. And if you're not protected by Section 245K, you need to leave USA, withdraw your 485, leave USA, come back with a visa, and reapply 485 with the date, if the dates are current. Then you are protected by 245K. But that's my general advice. I really don't know all the facts of your case, okay? Next question is C.M. Yadur. C.M. Yadur, something like that. I-539-4H4. Wife's I-94 expired September 30th. Applied 539 August 23rd, which means before the I-94 expired, at which time my H-1 extension was pending approval. Still under initial review, got my H-1 extension approved later, and my new I-94 is valid till 2014. Is it a matter of concern if it is not approved before 180-day period? When you say it, I understand that to mean your wife's H-4. Look, these are always dangerous things to comment on. I hope you are on the phone and you can talk with me. Maybe we can explore it further. You need to talk with your own lawyers. I don't think, generally speaking, let me put it to you this way. If there's no other complication, somebody's on H-4. You file an H-4 extension. It's received by USCIS before their current extension expires. That person can continue to stay in USA till the date their H-4 is decided or the date to which the H-4 extension was asked for. So let's say you asked for a six-month H-4 extension and the case was adjudicated in 3 months. They are entitled to stay here for 3 months. If the case was adjudicated in 9 months, they are entitled to stay here only for 6 months because you asked for 6 months only. You get my point? So when you apply for an H-4 in a timely manner, the person can stay here till the time of adjudication or the time you have asked for, whichever comes earlier. Okay? Again, I sometimes wonder what I have said. Does that make sense? Or to me, it makes perfect sense. I hope I'm making myself clear to you. If not, just, you know, ask follow-up questions. Then there is
Maninder Sahni, who says, entered USA in 2003 on F1, converted to H1, changed employers. First H1 since stamping in Vancouver, valid in 2009. Employer 2 filed perm. Employer 2 files I-140 approved. Employer 2 extends H1 to 2013. Change jobs in Employer 3. Employer 3 is approximately a $5 billion company in the high-tech industry. They have initiated green card again. Labor is underway. I plan to travel to India over Christmas and New Year this year. But a valid 797 in 2013. But Employer 3 has had some massive reorg and laid off approximately 10% people. So am I going to have trouble getting a visa? And the answer is anybody can have trouble. Visa stamping has become extremely unreasonable. H1 and H4 visa stamping has become very, very unreasonable. So under the given circumstances, is there a high probability to get H1 denied? I think you can be stuck in admin processing. I don't know about denial. Is this an increasing trend of delays? Yes, absolutely. Our offices has not only, we have noticed it 6 months ago, we wrote to some of the people who are advising the White House, some of the economic advisors, about these persistent issues that our community is facing. I don't see any betterment, but at least this has been brought to the notice of the White House. Is there anything I can do to better prepare to avoid this? I don't think so. I don't think you can, really. You can only hope for the best. You know, again, this may sound silly, but like in the Bollywood movies, they say, "Ab to dua kaam karegi, dawa kuch nahi kar sakti." It's kind of like that. You can only pray and hope for the best. EB2 green card. This is from CTIC. Sometimes I can't read the CTLLC. Okay. Question number one. We currently have an H-1B who has been working for us. So it's an employer who's writing this. We have an H-1B who has been working for us since 1 year. Okay, he's got a three-year degree. See, people who have a three-year degree can hardly ever qualify for EB-2. It's very, 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 very unlikely. There's one small exception for people who are exceptionally qualified and have 10 years of experience, but most people cannot take advantage of that exception. So EB-2 is very unlikely. If I were advising him, I would say go finish a master's degree. In the meantime, do an EB-3 green card. Maybe the priority it can be ported through your company or through some other company if a different job is available once he finishes his master's degree. We are 3 years in business. We have two employees, only one H-1B. So the question is, can we put him in the entrepreneur category if we give him equity? And the answer is probably not. Remember, USCIS has said H-1B visas are available for entrepreneurs. They never, ever gave us detailed instructions. So in theory, there is a policy out there, but nobody knows how it's going to work. Okay? So my preliminary reaction would be, just by giving equity in your company, you're not going to be able to make this any easier for your employees. Okay? Next question is Manish 13, 485 filing, priority date is current. PD was current in Jan bulletin. Company doesn't have tax returns. There is no requirement that company must give you W-2s or tax returns. I don't see why that should be a problem. All you need is a letter from the employer that the job is still being held open. And you don't need any educational documents also. 485 filing is not like that. You're misinformed. So something is not right here. Tax returns and all are needed for I-140, not for 485. Very good. I have finished answering all the questions that were posted on the forums. And let's see if we can get back and ask people if they have specific questions. If you have a question, please press *5 on your phone. Press *5 on your phone. Or it's 5-star or *5. I'm sorry. Try 5-star. I apologize. It's 5-star. Press 5-star on your phone. Okay. I have one question only. Okay. Let me unmute you. Area code 732, go ahead, please.
Rajivji, this is Venkatesh.
Yes.
This is regarding the question about my wife's H4 or H1 status.
Okay.
Because of the later approval of the H4.
Okay.
Based on the approval dates there, that is, the H-1B was approved with validity date from October 6th to September 30th of next year. And the H-4 was approved from October 2nd of this year. So based on that, is there any ruling that says that later validity period is the one that is valid?
No, there is no such rule. The last action rule only talks about whatever is approved last rules. And
Okay. Realistically
speaking, there is neither any legal grounds nor any legal precedent for this particular rule. So, I think you need to contact USCIS as well as the Ombudsman's Office and see if they can work this out, because it appears to be an area of the law nobody has thought about.
Okay. So you're meaning contacting USCIS is through the service center?
Yeah, you would call the customer service.
Okay.
In the problem, because this problem is rather complicated, they should be able to put you through to a service officer.
Okay.
Can then help you better. Also contact, if once you've tried this, then contact the USCIS Ombudsman's Office and open a case with them.
Okay. Now, do you think it is better that I get representation from a lawyer for doing this, or can I do this myself?
I think you are better off with a lawyer.
Okay.
Not because you cannot do it yourself. Let me think about this for a minute.
Okay.
You can try doing it yourself first. See, I like to save people money, but at the same time, some things you don't save money on, you just buy, problems.
Okay.
But in this case, at least try to make a couple of phone calls yourself, see if you can get this resolved. You know the issue. You know what is going on. It's simple English, you have to talk.
Okay.
If they give you something in writing, such as a new I-94 or even a notice that says, we've just noticed that you had asked for a withdrawal, so the H-4 is considered to be withdrawn as of the date of your request for withdrawal. You're all set.
Okay. Is there any other formal process that I can do for withdrawing the H-4 other than calling them in the first place?
You wrote them an email, a letter. That's what you're supposed to do.
Okay. Yeah, I wrote, the letter, initially, that is before the before the H-4 was approved, I wrote two letters to actually withdraw, but they didn't do anything about it. So should I actually do anything about those letters? Will they eventually see the letters and maybe withdraw the H-4 approval?
Let me ask you this question. You have proof of delivery of those letters?
Yes, yes, Rajivji, I have.
As long as you have those, I think you have covered all your tracks.
Okay.
At this point of time, nothing else needs to be done except get in touch with USCIS. And try to get this resolved as quickly as possible. Let's talk again in 2 weeks. Report back to me what's going on.
Okay, Rajivji, I'll do that. Thank you so much.
Good luck, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. Area code 704. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, if USAS issues any RFA while we are outside USA, can we re-enter using AP?
As long as it's just an RFE, because remember, unless the 485 is actually denied, AP is still valid.
No, what
is clarifying? Okay.
Right. Issuance of an RFE is not a denial.
Okay, if it is denied, then we can't enter using AP, right?
Then you cannot.
Okay.
All right.
Got it. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Area code 732 again.
Yes, sir. I was trying to get through.
Yeah, you're through.
Yes. Yeah, my question was related to the EB2. So you're saying that there is no way we can do EB2 in either category?
No, sir, if your employee has a three-year degree, even with 9 years of experience, I don't see how you can do an EB2 for him.
If we start with an EB3, he gets 10 years. After that, we give him an exception salary, a good bonus. Still, there is no possibility doing an EB2.
Look, it's a little bit more complicated than I can discuss in this little time that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it to you this way. Generally speaking, it is very difficult for you to get an EB2 for this employee.
Okay, what about if we do an EB5 where we have to pay $500,000, where the employee has to pay if he does it on his own? Would that money, is that recoverable after 2 years, or we just have to give it off to one of the government agencies, you know, where...
No. That money is invested by you.
Right.
By the employee.
Right.
And if it is invested in a regional investment trust...
Right.
Actually, I'll give you a quick rundown on EB-5 if we have enough time. I actually have a lot of questions.
I can hold on. You can finish everything else.
Let me finish everything else, and I need about 6 or 7 minutes of time to let you know exactly.
Sir, but I will be on the call, sir. I am on the call, so don't, you know, sometimes I can't get through because I don't know why, but I just want to let you know I will be on the call, sir.
All right. So let's call you John. Is that okay?
Oh, that's great. That's my nickname, actual nickname. That is what it is.
I'm psychic.
Oh, wow. That's great. Awesome.
hang on 1 second. Let me go on to the other people. I've got about 7 or 8 calls.
Sure, sir. I'm holding on, sir.
Yeah, I'll keep your line open, but I'll go on to the next
person. Okay? Sure, sir.
Area code 704, you have a question for me?
No.
Okay.
But thank you.
No problem. Okay. Let's go on to the next one. Area code 401.
Yeah, hi, Rajiv. My name is Prakash.
Yes, sir.
Actually, I have a question that, like, I'm working on L1B visa, L1 blanket.
Sure.
And my visa is expiring on May of 2012.
Okay.
And my fiancée is also working on L1B visa, and her visa is expiring on February 2013.
Right.
We both are planning to get married by end of this year.
All right.
In U.S. And later, I want to file the change of status and the EAD.
Okay.
And my question is, like, can I continue to work on L1 till, like, can I continue to work on L1 till my L1 is valid? At the same time, I can file the change of status and EAD?
The answer is yes, you can.
Okay. I have like around 6 to 7 questions. So is that okay?
As long as they take only a few minutes, yeah, go ahead. Yes and no questions I can answer.
Yeah. Like, and if I resign from my current company by giving a 3-week notice period, and I do this, and I resign my company before I get married, so can I file EAD and the change of status at that time? Is that legal?
Let me take this apart. This question is a little bit more complicated. The way it works is, first of all, the date on which USCIS receives your L2 application, you must be in valid L1 status. Clear?
Okay.
L1, the valid L1 status means you're working, you're getting paid for it. Clear?
Okay.
Now, U.S. laws, as far as I know, at least in D.C. and Virginia, where I'm admitted to practice law, do not require any notice from an employee. Okay? Notice is merely a tradition, and it may be even a contract you have signed with your employer. But
under
law, at least in D.C. and Virginia, and under immigration law, there is no notice requirement at all. Clear?
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's the way it works. Does that answer somewhat your question, or did I skip something?
No, I think it's answered my question. And the third one is like, what is the processing time of L2, which is a form I-539 and the form I-765? What is the normal processing time for that?
A few months. EADs are typically about 90 days. What you need to do is you can go to USCIS website or even immigration.com, our website. We provide links to various USCIS processing times, and you can look at the processing time for each form in the service center where you're sending in your information.
Okay, okay. And, like, which filing is better? Like, whether it is better to file e-file or give the form in person to USCIS?
I prefer postal filing over e-filing, but I do e-filing when I don't have enough time for the postal filing.
Oh, okay, okay. And the thing is, like, my I-94 is expiring in May 2014, and my visa is expiring in May 2012. So does that make any difference? Like, after May 2012, can I legally stay in U.S.?
It is the I-94 that controls your stay in USA.
Okay, okay, okay.
Right?
Okay, and just, I think it's just two more. Like, the total stay a person can stay in U.S. on a work visa is for 6 years. And
oh,
I'm completing my
L1. L1B is 5 years. L1A is 7 years. H1 is 6 years.
Yeah, right. Okay, okay, okay. And I'm completing my 5 years in May of 2012. And if I file my EAD and work for the next 6 months and later go for H1B, so does the EAD days count for the work visa? Will I get an extra 1 year for the H-1B?
No, but there is a rule somewhere in the federal regulations, I don't remember it off the top of my head, where if you have exhausted 5 years of L-1B, you probably cannot get H-1 also. Double check on that rule. I don't remember the rule, but there is something like that out there.
Okay, okay, all right, all right.
But if you apply like 6 months left on the 5 years, you may be able to get 1 year of H-1. Some rule like that. Just make sure that, you know, there's nothing like that out.
Okay, okay. And I think you have answered all my questions. Just last thing. Is there any grace period on L1 blankets? So suppose if I resign my company and I don't want to go back to India right away.
No,
so
there
is there any grace period, like 2 weeks or something, before I go back to my home country?
No, sir. Not even 1 day grace period.
Oh. Okay, okay. And I think I'm done from my side.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, I have 4 more questions. Let's go with area code 215. Go ahead, please, 215.
This is a follow-up question to that I-539 for my wife that I had applied
before
it expired, and then it was a question regarding that 180-day grace period.
Sure.
So, did you foresee any problem, like, if it is not approved? So what are the steps should I take? Like, is there any steps that I can take now to get it expedited, to get it approved, the I-539 application?
I'm sorry. Are you the gentleman whose H-1 was approved, 539 is pending?
Yes.
In other words, your wife's 539, it was timely filed but pending, and you had a question, can she stay beyond 180 days? Is that, are you the person?
Yes.
Okay. Well, there is really no way to expedite an I-539. You can certainly call USCIS and find out if there's anything extraordinary going on in the case that they can tell you. But other than that, there really is nothing special that you can do. If your case has proceeded several months beyond normal processing time, you can bring it to the attention of USCIS.
Is it through the ombudsman office or is it directly can I call them?
The normal customer service, you can let them know.
Okay.
They might direct you to send a fax to a certain phone number or an email.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but contact the USCIS customer service, let them know. And if they are not inclined to help, then you go ahead and contact the ombudsman.
Okay, but if we are close to 180 days period, should we plan to...
The 180
send
days
my...
is not a problem. As long as, like I told you, as long as the H-4 was timely filed, I don't see why that should be a problem. But again, you know, please check your case, details of your case with your lawyers. I am merely suggesting, based upon general information that I have, somebody needs to look at your timeline, sit down with you, go over your H-1 approval, go over your H-4 filing, see what exactly was filed, when it was filed, how much time was asked for. I personally don't think there's a problem, but that's my guess, not a definitive opinion.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. Let me go on to area code 973, please.
Hello, Mr. Rajiv. This is Balaji. I have a question on my green card processing. I work for a multi-billion dollar company, and last year, I think April 2010, my company filed for a perm in EB3, and I got an audit in the month of September last year, and I filed for an H1 extension this year, like around March, and my H1 extension got approved. They gave me a one-year extension by first week of May, and immediately after that, my labor got rejected. I'm actually maxing out on my H1, my six-year stay by like end of this month. And what happened was my company said they'll file another perm. This time they filed a perm in EB2 in the month of September. And last week, I got another audit on the new perm as well. Now, my visa, like even after, you know, beyond the 6 year also, I have, it's valid until May 2012, which is like I have 5 more months left. And since my perm was filed like less than 365 days from my visa expiry date, I have to get my perm as well as my I-140 approved within the next 5 months so that I can file for another extension on my visa. Going by the current processing time, that looks like a very distant possibility. And what my company told was, I can wait until May and leave the country after my visa is expired, or just before my visa expires. And once, you know, the audit result comes through, they can file for an I-140 and also file for a fresh H-1, and I can come back once that H-1 is approved. Now, my question is it like, since I'm maxing out on my visa, should I necessarily stay like 1 year outside the country and before coming into the country again on a fresh H-1 or L-1 visa?
No. You can come back whenever the earlier of the following two things happen.
Okay.
One, you become eligible for an H-1 extension beyond 6 years. Or two, you have stayed outside for 1 year. So let's say in 3 months after you leave, your I-140 is approved, you can come back.
Okay, so even after I leave, if my I-140 gets approved, I can come back and then file for an extension, or should I come on a new H-1?
Let me explain to you what happened here.
Okay.
About 3 years ago, before Bill Yates retired, the USCIS thinking was that the use of the word H-1 extension presupposes that you must be on H-1 in order to get extension beyond 6 years. So if there's a gap of even 1 day between your old H-1 expiring and you asking for an extension beyond 6 years, you cannot get it.
Okay.
But Bill Yates, on December 31st, I want to say this is back in 2007 or 8, December 31st, he issued a memo, like a Happy New Year gift to everybody, that we don't care if there is a gap between two H-1s. We will give you an extension as soon as you become eligible for one, even if you are not currently on H-1.
Okay.
I think that's your concern. Am I right?
Yes, because I wasn't sure, like,
if
I leave the country and...
Even if there's a gap,
you have
no problem.
Okay, so it doesn't matter even if I have maxed out on my visa and exceeded my stay. Even if I go back and come back, if my I-140 is approved, I can still get an extension or come on a fresh H-1, right?
Yes, sir. Hang on. John, you are still here. I have actually still about 5-6 questions to go.
Okay.
Yes.
You can either continue to hold. I'll be happy to give you a free consultation.
Yes,
sir. Right.
You can also send an email if you like, or you can continue to hold.
Okay. I will hold on, sir.
All right. Back to the multi-billion-dollar employee. Go ahead, sir. By the way, I find that your case was very strangely handled. I'm not sure what happened. the way I would have handled it was, when your first perm got denied, I would have filed an appeal against that. As long as the appeal is pending, which is the next 2-3 years, you're entitled to your H-1 extension. Then
okay.
I would have filed a second perm for a different position, like an EB-2.
Okay.
That's the way I would have handled it. But I'm sure they have smart lawyers. There must be a reason why it didn't work out like that.
Okay. And it is not necessary that I should be physically present in the country to file for an I-140, right? Like even
no.
if I leave the country, if my labor is approved, my company can still file for I-140, right?
Absolutely. No problem at all.
Okay. Okay, I think that answers all my questions, sir. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Now, area code 216, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. Sir, my name is Ramesh, and I am currently on an F1 visa. I came to U.S. in August 2008 on F1 for Ohio State University. And in January of 2010, I transferred to ITU in California, and I was in ITU till April. And from April to June, I was in Tri-Valley, and afterwards I worked out with my university, and in August, I came back to Ohio State to continue my education. And this summer, I completed my MS, and I applied for OPT. On the OPT, I got a query like to show me proof that I was in California when I was studying in ITU from January to April, and proof of my Tri-Valley transcripts and everything. I don't have, I never went to California in my life. I took online courses in ITU. At the time when I was in ITU, the DSO promised me that I could take online courses, but I do not have any concrete proof of that. So on the RFE, I contacted a lawyer, and the lawyer advised me not to reply to RFE and instead go back to India and get a new initial I-20 and re-enter India on the same visa. My visa is valid till 2013.
Yeah,
is it a good thing to do, sir?
Hang on. That's bad advice in my opinion, because technically, if you are out of status for even one day, your visa
okay.
is automatically canceled.
Okay.
You should not be traveling on that visa. As a practical
okay.
matter, because CBP, they are the people who interview you at the airport, Customs and Border
okay.
Protection, CBP has no way of keeping track of when you are out of status. They may not know that your visa is no good for entry. But in the Tri-Valley University cases, I have seen all three possibilities. Possibility one,
okay.
people enter with new I-20, old visa, no problem. Possibility
okay.
two, people tried to enter with old visa, new I-20, they were turned away at the airport, go back, get a new visa.
Yeah.
Possibility three, the worst one, tried to enter, turned back, and put on a 5-year exclusion, can't come back for 5 years.
Okay.
All three are possibilities. I would never, ever recommend you to come back on the same visa.
Okay, like my lawyer advised that if I reply to RFE, the USCIS will come to know that I was in out of status while I was in ITU for 4 months, and they may issue me an NTA.
So they issue you an NTA, you ask for voluntary departure. You can always go back and come back on a new visa. You can send in a response to the RFE saying, you know what, I am leaving because it turns out that I'm out of status. You know, be truthful with the government. I don't like playing games with the government in any of the benefits cases. I mean,
okay.
if somebody, look, here is my approach to the practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
If my client is being charged with something serious, such as a criminal,
okay.
criminal offense, criminal issue, I will not let my client say anything.
Okay.
You decide to say nothing, let the government prove what you did wrong.
Okay.
But in benefits cases where you're asking the government for a change of status or something, I don't want you to play any games. Be outright straight about it, you know, because all of these are civil problems. They're not criminal issues. So,
okay.
You know, my approach would have been you respond to the RFE the best you can.
Okay.
If you want a sample RFE response to these kind of issues, we have put one out in the public domain. If you don't know where to get one, send me an email through the contact us form
okay.
on immigration.com. We'll send you a sample response. You take that
okay.
response, modify it according to your own facts, and second,
okay.
you're probably not going to win the case. You probably will still have to leave USA and come back on F1.
Okay.
You can also do this. You can just send in a letter saying, I'm leaving. I'm going to go get an F1 visa stamp and come back. Or you can go for an H1.
Okay. Sir, one more thing. Like, instead of replying to the RFE, can I transfer to another college and continue to be in F1 until April when I can file for H1?
This problem is not going to go away.
Yeah.
So you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
This problem is not going to go away. Transferring to another university is not going to help you. Either you win this case with USCIS or you leave USA and come back on new F1 visa or H1 visa. Those are the only two options that I know.
Okay. Sir, what are the chances of getting an F1 visa, especially after this thing with TVU and ITU in my record?
Quite poor.
Yeah.
Quite poor.
Okay.
Right? But we have to be realistic.
Sir,
I don't want to give you any false expectations. If you were my own brother, this is the way I would handle it. Look, these are the two options we've got. We've got to be tough-minded. We've got to confront reality and then take it from there.
Okay. So you advise me to reply to the RFA and wait for the decision or reply to the RFA and immediately leave U.S.?
Yes, sir. You can be put, but look at the new priorities of the government. They are not going to put you in deportation. I mean, they could, at least theoretically they could. But even if they do put you in deportation, you ask for voluntary departure and you leave.
Okay.
An NTA is not a death sentence.
Okay.
Okay.
So in some cases, while reentry, I mean, if I try reentry, you mean to say the CBP very much knows that I was in tri-valley, so I violated my status.
Well, I really don't know if they do know or they don't. They might. That's not really the issue. The issue is, will this ever come up in the future? And the answer is yes. At some point, this is going to come up, and this is going to probably haunt you. So one way or the other, you've got to deal with it.
So, I'm thinking of a case where suppose I take the risk and try, I get an admission in an MBA in a university here, and I try for re-entry on the same old visa. And if I successfully am able to come here, will that still haunt me? Like, if I apply for H1 after re-entry, will I still have to answer
back
to
the new visa stamp? You're okay. But if you try to convert within USA, you are not okay.
Okay. So even if I do the re-entry successfully, I may still get the same RFE when applying for H1.
If you are using the same old visa, you might have the same problem.
Okay.
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 You know what? Feel free to send me an email.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be happy to give you some free time, and we can talk about this a little bit more.
Okay, sir. I'll send you an email. Do you want me to write anything in the subject line? Attention, anything?
Just remind me. I'm old, but I'm not that old. You can just remind me what we talked about just now. And just say, Rajiv, we talked about my TVU issue, and you said that you give me a few minutes time so we can talk a little bit more about this.
Okay.
I'll toss it around. Think about what we just said, what we just spoke about. There isn't a whole lot I've got to add to it, but at least I can push you in the right direction. That's the most I can get.
Yeah, the main reason I'm concerned of is because I have some student loan over here, and if I go back to India, I guess it may take some time for me to clear that loan.
You know, look, I've been dealing with students' issues for a couple of decades, almost three decades now, including some of the school closures, including the TVU issues. So, you know, I know what government is thinking. I can give you an idea of what they have done, because yours is one case, and your lawyer may not have ever seen a TVU case before. I have seen over 500 TVU cases.
Yeah.
Okay. And I spoke with the prosecution on the TVU, on Susan Sue's prosecution team. I spoke with the agent in charge of the investigation. I also have been involved to a certain extent with this Northern Virginia Community College fiasco. So, you know, we kind of understand what the government is thinking. In cases like this, it's best to come clean and deal with these issues as early as possible. So, again, you may not like my advice, but this is the way I feel. If you are a member of my family, my friend, my brother, that's what I would have you do.
Okay, I got it, sir.
Okay, good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, I have three more questions. please, no more hands. I'll do the three more, then I'll try to deal with John's issues. Oh, no, please don't raise any more hands, guys. Okay. Area code 313, please, go ahead. Area code 313. Okay. Area code 805.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Harish.
Hi, Harish.
Hi. Actually, I have a typical case of that L1 to H1. So, I'm in US like till since 2009 August, and my visa was till July 2010 with the I-94. So I transferred from L1 to H1 on like 28th of November. So I applied with the change of status. I got a new I-94 with the start validity date of 28, and the end is 2014. Now, my question is, like, I was serving the notice period with L1, and suddenly I came to know that nobody knows the law that I have to move to H1 on the first day.
Right. Right. So, hello, Harish?
Yeah, I'm here.
So, you basically continued working on L1 when you had already received change of status to H1, is that correct?
Yeah, that is like 15 days back, 28th of November 2011.
Okay. Did you get the approval notice? A notification after you had done serving your time?
No, I got the notification, like, the validity date is 23rd, but I got the notification from employer, like, on 29th and 30th, but the employer even didn't know the law, and he said that you can join us, like, after 15 days.
Yeah, you have made a mistake, and you have definitely violated status. There is no question about that. You have two options, either continue working on H1, hoping that you can take advantage of something called de minimis violation, which means very small violation.
Uh-huh. Okay.
One second.
Hello. Okay.
One
so, but
second.
If yeah, sure.
Okay. So we can either help have you do that, hope for a de minimis violation, not as something that you've done on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if I want to now join the
getting pinged from my office because somehow my status got changed to available instead of being not available. So that's one option. Second option is to just go get a visa stamp and come back.
My visa is already stamped till 2012.
No, your H-1 visa.
Okay, my H-1 visa.
Yeah, because you want to work on H-1, right? Not on L-1?
When I resigned, my L-1 employer has given me a good option, actually. So
do you want to go back for the L-1 or do you want to work on H-1?
I want to go back to the L-1.
What you need to do is go outside USA, get a new visa stamp.
Not the old visa.
No, get a new visa stamp. The consulate will tell you, you don't need a new stamp. You're good till 2012. You let them know, look, I was in technical violation of my status.
So basically you're saying if I don't do a new visa, I could have a problems at the port of entry.
You can have a problem, port of entry, 485, many different ways.
I have one option. Basically, the client is ready to wait for 1.5-2 months. So can I join the H-1 new employer and can I file an H-1 transfer?
You have worked without authorization on L-1.
Correct.
So you have violated status already. You cannot unring a bell that has already been rung.
Okay, so
there is only two options. Hope that it's ignored as a minimal violation and not made an issue of by the government.
Okay.
Or go get a visa stamp. Whichever one you want to work on, H-1, if you want to work on H-1, L-1 if you want to work on L-1.
Because the L-1 stamping is like, you know, it's not easy these days.
Nothing is easy. H-1 is not easy either. But
okay.
This is you can, of course, try to change status again back to L-1 within USA. Do a premium filing. Explain to the government what happened. They may give you a change of status within USA.
But how come to L-1? Because I am not with the employer, basically. Because H-1 to L-1, I will be filing with the old employer then.
What is the question again?
No, what I'm saying is you're telling me to go get back the status from H1 to L1, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But when we say H1 to L1, then the company can't do that because I'm not with the same company because I've already shifted to the H1 employer.
You can still go back to the same L1 if you want to.
But for that, you're like saying I have to go out, get a new L1 stamp, and then come back.
You can. You have two choices. You can apply for L1 within USA again. Hope that you will get it.
After shifting to the H1 employer, you think?
Yes. Whatever you're doing right now is illegal.
You know, I'm actually shifting to the H1 employer tomorrow. Like, I'm shifting to the H1 employer.
But you already worked illegally for the L1 employer.
I worked illegally for 20 days, correct.
Doesn't matter. Even if you worked one day, it is too much.
Okay. So
now the question is the government going to make a big issue of it? I hope not. But can we depend upon that? No. We cannot.
So what do you suggest? Should I go back to... I join my H1 employer?
Sir, you don't want to hear what I have to say. I started with my suggestions. I told you the options that you've got. Hope the government doesn't make an issue of it, or to correct the situation.
To correct the situation, you are saying...
The two possibilities to correct the situation, go outside, get a visa, or apply for a change of status back again.
Apply for a change of status back to L1 if I want to continue with the L1 employer.
Absolutely.
But you're not suggesting a H1 to H1 transfer with the old employer.
You can. But you got to do something. You just cannot. If you don't want to take a chance with the government, you know, calling out, you have to do something about it. So you may not like my answers, but they are the only two answers I know. Think it through. You need to talk with your lawyers, talk with your employers, and figure out that which makes most sense to you. Personally, I would probably send you for a visa stamp. Very difficult, yeah.
So you're saying you will, if you insist, then you will send me, go back to India, get an H1 or L1 stamp?
I would probably send you to Mexico or Canada first. See if it gets done there.
To Mexico or Canada and come back on the L1 visa?
Either one, L1 or H1. If you want to do an H1 for the new employer, file an H1 premium processing. See if the government is going to give you a status change within USA. That violated status. It's really, you know, this is something you're going to have to talk with your own lawyers. I can only give you the general direction. It's a decision that has to be made between you, your lawyers, and your employers. What do they feel comfortable with?
Okay. Basically, it is. But US, if I go to, because for Canada and Mexico, they are saying, because I don't have both the I-94s to submit. My new N-94 is my H-1 employer, actually.
Still, the answer is the same. It doesn't really matter who's got the I-94. You've got the problem. I don't care who's got the I-94.
Yeah, so if I go to Canada or Mexico, submit the old 1994, get back with the new I-94 inside, then I can continue working on L1, you are saying.
I didn't say that. You have to get a new visa stamp.
A stamped visa.
Mm-hmm.
A new petition, basically, you are saying.
Oh, a visa stamp from the consulate.
Okay. Rajiv, if you don't mind, from your...
I really have other people to attend to. Let me give you bottom line. I know that I'm confusing you. Let me give you the bottom line.
Okay.
You need a new visa stamp or a change of status.
Okay.
You have the following options. Go outside USA, get an L1 visa stamp because your L1 petition is still good till 2012.
Okay.
Or get an H1 stamp if you want to work for the H1 employer.
Okay.
If you want to work for the L1 employer with an H1, you need to file H1 change of status premium processing and make it clear to the government that you have violated status.
Okay.
If they give you status within U.S., they forgive you, great. If not, you will go outside U.S., get an H-1 visa stamp for the L-1 employer and come back. That's the bottom line.
Okay. I got that. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Guys, I'm sorry. I have to push people along. There's still 5-6 more people. I don't know how many I can do. Area code 303, go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Anuj. I have two questions, actually, simple. First, I just filed for my adjustment of status, on September last week. I mean, I belong to EB2 current, the rest of the world. What happened is, like, my wife's I-485 got approved, like, you know, even 1 week after the fingerprinting. But mine is still under the initial review. So, I mean, have you seen something like this? Like, it's employment-based.
Are you the primary and she the secondary?
Yes. No, I am the primary, yeah.
That's dumb as hell, but they do it. So I have seen that happen. In fact, I have a case in which the wife even applied for her naturalization while the husband's 485 is still pending. 5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, and the second question is, I want to take you back to 2009. What happened was I was working for a company, and, you know, because of this economic downturn and all, the company went into liquidation, basically. You know, so that process took like 6 months, and for those 6 months, we were not getting paid and all. So the company finally liquidated in December, and
okay.
I managed to find my... Yeah.
1 second. Were you working and not getting paid, or were you not even working?
No, I was working. I was working on internal projects. But
if I were your lawyer, I would argue that was sufficient maintenance of status, because I was ready, willing, and able to work and working. If the employer did not pay me, it isn't because I wasn't working. It's because they were in liquidation.
Right, because we knew that the company is in liquidation, so they said that out of the speed of the liquidation, they're going to make a settlement in the liquidation, which they did, but it was definitely not as per the LCA and all. So
I'll tell you this. Your 45 could be in trouble unless your lawyer can forcefully argue these points.
Well, but what happened was I got a new job in 2009 December. I left the country in February, and I came back, but not with the visa stamp. I came back with the new I-94 with the new employer's name in it. So does that take care of everything?
If you go really by the book, no. Because once you are out of status for even 1 day, the visa is automatically canceled. It should not be used. But people do it all the time, and if you ask my guess, I don't think USCIS will make an issue of it. I think you're going to be out.
Okay. Oh, okay. It's been like 2 years, and since then, I've always been in regular status. So,
yeah, they can still make an issue if they want to, but I don't think they will. That's my guess.
All right. Okay, great.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, man. Okay. Area code 216, please. 216. Okay, very good.
Hello.
Oh, just 1 second. I just muted you. 1 second. Yeah, go ahead, please. I can hear you.
Yes, sir. Sir, I spoke with you just a few minutes back. I'm from Ohio State University. Sir, when I spoke, just one follow-up question which I forgot. My lawyer told me this one point which I want to clarify through you. He told me that if we enter U.S. on a new initial I-20, same visa, and if we are successful, we'll get a new I-94, and that new I-94 will cancel out any status violations which are made previously.
The problem is this, that this advice is incorrect, in my opinion.
Pardon, sir, I could not hear you. Sorry about that.
This advice, in my opinion, is incorrect.
Okay.
If you're out of status, your visa is automatically canceled. If you enter using that visa, that could be a problem.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
I've got to go on. You can set up a separate time with me, but I've got to go on and finish my call, okay?
Okay, thank you, sir.
Little bit over. Okay, good luck. I have only time for a quick overview of EB-5 with John. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm there, sir.
Okay, so folks, everybody else can hang up if you don't want to be bored. But this is the way EB-5 works, John.
Yes,
there
sir.
Is $1 million investment and there is $500,000 investment. Okay?
Okay.
$1 million investment you can make in new business, existing business where you increase the value of the business by a certain amount, or in a troubled business which has lost 20% of its value. Similarly, $500,000 So I'm not even talking too much about the $1 million investment. I'm talking only about the $500,000. The $500,000 you can invest as follows. You can invest it yourself, or you can invest it through a government-approved investment scheme. That does not guarantee your money. The government does not guarantee the scheme. They only think it meets the immigration requirements. Clear?
So you mean to say if we give it to one of the government agencies, to one of the, you know, regional centers, we cannot get our money back? Is that
No. First of all, these are not government agencies. Wipe that out of your mind. These are not government agencies. These are private individuals.
Okay.
There are one or two or three investment centers that were run by state governments, but these are not government agencies. 100-plus of them are all privately owned, privately operated. The government has examined these only for immigration law compliance, not for any other purpose.
Okay.
Okay? So the way it works is you put in your money with them. They hold on to the money. You get your temporary green card. After 2 years, you remove the condition, it becomes a permanent green card. After a certain period, you can take the money back depending upon the agreement you have with the regional service center. The money doesn't become theirs, nor does it have to be there forever.
Okay.
But bear in mind that because these are private individuals, you don't know what they're going to do with your money. Are they going to be successful in making it a good business? Are they going to lose all your money? Who knows?
Okay.
Okay, so you have to do a proper analysis whether this particular investment center is doing a good job, who is managing it, how many cases have they processed, things like that you've got to assess. Where are the people with their money? Okay.
So you
can't help you do that. That's a financial assessment.
Okay. And we have to have this $500 only by ourselves, by earning ourselves. It couldn't be that a company can sponsor him.
$500,000 can come from loan. It can come from gift. It can come as your own money. It can come as a promissory note based upon an obligation secured by your assets. Okay. So it can be a bunch of different things. A combination of a bunch of different things as well, as long as the money is coming from legal sources.
So you are saying we can, this employee of ours, we can also gift him $500,000 as a company?
I'm not a tax lawyer, but I believe if you gift money to somebody, you have to pay 20% income tax.
Okay, so we're talking about $700,000 then, right?
But if you loan the money, that's not a problem.
Okay. Oh, we can give him as a loan?
Yes, you can loan the money. That has no tax consequences. When he takes the loan, nobody pays taxes. When he returns the money, nobody pays taxes.
Okay. So, but this will not affect his H-1 in any way, right?
It should not, no, because it's a parallel track.
Okay. Okay. And he could even have an asset like his home or something where, you know, he could put that back on his mortgage if he's paid full off, and he can take that money and give it as well, whatever he can arrange it.
Some amount of it can come from that. As long as the money is secured by legal means, I don't see any reason why he can't get the money as a mortgage, money from a mortgage. I don't see any problem with that.
Okay, so right now we have $500,000, and we give him $500,000 as a loan right now. We can do that. He goes and gives this to a regional center. He has a chance of losing this money if the investor goes bankrupt, the regional center goes bankrupt, right? Is that what you're saying? But he will still end up getting his green card. Am I right?
Wait. If the investment center goes bankrupt, he loses his money and he does not get the green card.
Okay. So that's a huge risk.
It is a huge risk. So you have to be very careful. We have done a few of these cases, and our clients have analyzed the investments, and they've gone with two different centers, most of them, but this is something we cannot really comment about. We've done some with $1 million investment. By the way, I didn't finish. That $500,000, you can either put in an investment trust or you can invest it yourself in a certain way and create 10 American jobs over 2 years, and you can manage the investment yourself.
But can this Can this employee open a company and hire people? Like, he's on H-1. How can he do that?
He cannot, but he can have a business plan to do it once he gets his green card.
Okay, but he can hire a U.S. citizen and open a company through him? Is that what you're saying? And he'd have a 90% stake in that?
No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Actually, it's some ways simpler and some ways more complicated. Look, EB-5 money has to be put at risk. So if you have a very definite business scheme in mind and a detailed business plan, including, you know, some details like I've done analysis of competing businesses, there's actually a whole lot of requirements for a good business plan. Without even starting the company, but by putting in money at risk, he can actually start the company himself. And the law is that he's got to create 10 American jobs over the next 2 years. And the business plan should clearly show how he will do that. In order for it to be $500,000, that money has to be invested in one of the following ways. Number one, either it has to be invested in a high unemployment area where the employment is 50% of the national average. So if the national average is 10%, you've got to invest the money somewhere where it's 15% unemployment.
Okay.
And the unemployment must be 15% either when the money is invested or when the application is made. Okay?
Okay. Okay.
So either in a high unemployment area or in a rural area or in a targeted employment area, which is also kind of a high unemployment area, but a little different than that. It's a determination made by the local agencies about what is targeted employment. California has a lot of TEAs, so different states have TEAs. So these are some of the ways you can invest the money and manage it yourself. What is difficult about this is the creation of 10 American jobs, and the paperwork is very complicated. It's not impossible. We've done cases like this. Paperwork is because you have to do a lot of paperwork. You have to show them your business plan. You have to show them how that money is being used to create American jobs, not just, you know, setting up a company, but actually creating the job. Money has to be linked to creation of the job.
We can do that because we currently are doing that ourselves right now. We have created like 30 jobs, and this is through this employee who's on H-1B. It is through him that we are having this $2 million revenue every year. So that is what we wanted to help him out in order to work.
Why don't you invest $1 million in your own company?
Okay. We can do that.
Why not?
But he's on our H-1.
Because the point is he's not going to start working for that company until his green card is approved. He continues working as an employee, and then he becomes a business partner.
But so you're saying that he would invest the money in our company itself if we give him a loan? Is that what you're saying?
Why not? It is going to be definitely a little bit more complicated because there are some laws, and if I remember correctly, there are some rulings from Administrative Appeals Office about a company providing the money out of the proceeds of its own actions. Now, if the money is coming from the partners and the stockholders, that's different. But
It's coming from our clients where we have made 30 jobs available for our U.S. citizens.
Yeah, but the next 10 jobs must come because of that $1 million investment.
Okay.
So, well, you know what? You should think about this a little bit more. Why don't you go ahead and
Set
out all the questions you have. We can always set up a consultation for you. It'll have to be a formal consultation. We'll charge you for my time. But
no, that's okay. I know. That's fine. I've already...
You're also welcome. Before you narrow down these issues, you're welcome to come back in 2 weeks with more questions.
All right. Okay. Can I just ask you one more thing, if you don't mind?
No, you can.
Just one last question. His LCO was approved for $51,000. But now we are paying him a higher salary. I know we don't have to pay less than the LCA prevailing wage, but we can pay more. But if we pay him like a $100,000 bonus and we are paying him more than the average position what he's in, is that going to be a problem for his H-1 also? Or
here's what you need to do. You need to set up a call with me anyway.
Because
I need to tell you, I don't know what kind of representation you have for your H-1s and green cards. You need to understand how to set up your infrastructure so that you are not in violation of the laws. Technically speaking, giving a bonus is not a problem if you have a reason for the bonus.
Okay.
Okay. So I'll explain to you. I need about a half hour with you to
sure.
how to set the infrastructure.
Okay.
And if you do it right, you could go from 30 companies to 3,000, 30 employees to 3,000 employees. The same infrastructure will hold.
Okay. Okay. All right.
You spend
got
3 hours now on setting things up, and you will be in compliance of every immigration law for the next X number of years.
Okay. Got it. So right now I will arrange a call, but right now you're saying there's no need to give him a bonus, but just keep him around the $50,000 to $60,000 range.
$10,000
is enough, right?
A bonus can be given if it is given based upon criteria that you uniformly apply to all employees.
Okay.
Okay. For example, again, I'll take 2 minutes. I'll give you an example. We tell people to create spreadsheets. Saying
right.
our base salary for a software engineer level 2 is 55,000, but then there are variations based upon the following 12 factors. Factor 1. Technical competence above and beyond normal, between $2,000 and $7,000. Ability to bring new business, between $5,000 and $15,000.
Okay.
Billing rate, high billing rate, $3,000 to $30,000, depending upon. So you can have these factors, and you've got to apply that to every employee.
Okay, understood.
And then you can have variations. That's not a problem.
Okay. All right. It's basically intercompany infrastructure as to how. We are following policies. That's what you're saying.
That's right. And you've got to have uniformized policies. After all, you're paying him not because he's good-looking. It's because he deserves something extra.
Right, right, right. Absolutely.
So,
all right.
Therefore,
you've got to
have these policies in place.
Sure, sir. I will set up a consultation with you with the paid conference, what you have on your website, and I will love to talk to you about the EB-5 as to how you can give me more details. Because, I'll be honest with you, I went to Murthy and I paid for the conference, and she was so much in a hurry as if she was meeting President Obama. You know, she didn't even bother to answer my questions in detail. I had a very bad experience with her, sir.
Well, no, that's not, every lawyer is different. I don't know President Obama. I don't know any lawyer. I only know my work, sir. That's all I know.
Right. No, I just want to let you know I had a very bad experience. I paid the money up front to Murthy Law Firm. And she did not bother to answer my question, sir. She was in a hurry to answer everything, and you take all the time, even in your free conference, you have spent like more than 30 minutes than usual. So I'm really thankful and grateful for your help, sir.
Look, let me explain something to you. Everybody does what is good for them. For other law firms, it is important to be high visibility and, perhaps make a difference politically. I only know how to do my work. I don't care about anything else. So whatever works for you, man, that's all I've got to say. We do our job, do it well, we enjoy it. That's all we need to do.
Sure, sir.
All right, and hopefully we'll talk with you soon. Good luck, and not to worry. I'm sure this can be straightened out for you.
All right, sir. Sure, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate you being here. Bye-bye.